We have a call. Let's go on the air with this call.
You're on Freak Radio Santa Cruz. Thanks for calling.
Hey, this is Ryan Harvey calling from the DNC to RNC March.
Oh, great. Thanks for calling, Ryan.
How's it going?
Great. How are you doing?
Good. I'm good. I was just told I might want to call up here.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for calling in. We've been talking about the DNC to the RNC March today on the show. And we just spoke with Cedar and Peter, Gianna and Cody. So tell us your observations, Ryan. Tell us what it's been like. How long have you been involved in the DNC to RNC organizing?
Sure. For the first update, I'm sure you already heard that we went through the relics of the hurricane today, and everyone's bags were soaking wet and clothing.
No, we didn't even hear about that.
Oh, well, yeah, so we went through the relics of the hurricane today, and I was actually just hanging up all my clothes to dry because all of them are soaking wet, and everyone's real cold and wet. It's the second time so far that we've gone through a huge rainstorm and woken up in, like, puddles and stuff. But, so, I've been involved for a few months now. I've been mainly working on the music aspects of the march, trying to get musicians to come along for the march and perform during it. And I've been setting up an event in New York on August 26th as our finale event. One of our ongoing projects for the march is that we're recording. There's like a lot of different musicians who have come out for the march or who happen to be on the march. And we're recording songs and stuff from rallies, from the march, from events we've thrown, open mics and stuff, and just sitting around at nighttime. And we're going to make a CD of that and put it out of just songs from the march. And so far the march is just, like, it's bigger than I thought it would be in terms of numbers of people, and it's more diverse than I thought it would be. In terms of, it's not all, like, young white activists. There's lots of different folks coming out from different backgrounds and such, which has made it interesting. And we've, you know, found that a lot of, like, the types of organizing that we're used to aren't as easy and aren't as necessary with this group because it's more diverse and people aren't used to the way I've organized in the past. It's taught us a lot. And then in terms of, like, community support, I honestly had no idea that so many people had lost faith in the electoral system, and people are totally in support of our message, and we got a lot of honks and cheers and sometimes raised fists from, you know, like, regular people. And, you know, like, soccer moms will come with their kids and join the march for an afternoon, and people will make us iced tea and lemonade and food, and farmers will give us their, you know, parts of their produce and stuff. And it's really amazing. It's been, you know, quite, you know, that aspect of it has been amazing. And then the other aspect of it is, like, logistical, and that's been real stressful. It's, you know, it's hard to step back sometimes and be like, whoa, we're actually doing this, and it's going really well, because, you know, most of the time you're like, you walk 10, 15 miles, and then you're in a meeting for 2 hours, and then you've got to do the dishes, or you've got to, you know, get to sleep and wake up at 6 a.m. to wake people up, or cook breakfast, or drive the route and make sure it's all confirmed and stuff. And then once you're on the route, you've got to, you know, you could be the back biker and make sure everyone's staying with the march, or you could be the police liaison, or you could hold the banner. And there's always, you know, everyone's got something to do always, so it's hard to get, like, the free time to be like, wow, look what we're actually doing and stuff. But, I mean, it's pretty intense, and it's pretty awesome. It's been a great experience so far.
How does it compare to the march that you were on from Immokalee, Florida to Miami?
I actually wasn't on the Root Cause march.
Oh.
At all. So.
Well, what I was thinking, too, was that this was seeming to be a model, you know, that people are using, is marching long distances.
Certainly.
And how do you see that kind of evolving, or where do you think we can go with this? How do you think we could bring marches like that, you know, to different parts of the country?
Yeah, I mean, I think where it's
where you're at too is obviously a great place to be marching.
Certainly, Yeah, I think that like distance marches, especially after being on this one, like it can burn out main organizers definitely like pretty quickly. So it's really important that there's like a broad effort on the part of lots of people to participate in all the different aspects, and that it's organized really transparently so that the power is shared among a group of like a larger group of people. And if it's done right, then I think it's a super effective way of building a movement. Because it's movement building. It's not a protest. We're walking directly through communities. And I don't say that rhetorically, like we're actually walking through people's neighborhoods and like they're on their lawn and we're talking to them and we're putting flyers, on mailboxes and, giving them to people as we walk past and going into stores and talking to people. And, you know, it's amazing. I mean, you know, like people get to ask the questions that they never get to ask, and they get to see us in person. The media in the past has painted such horrible pictures of us, and the media, the little media outlets along the march route so far have had no choice but to give positive stories about us because they just know that they can't get away with lying when we've so openly shown ourselves to the community that, you know, the constituents of the media. So, you know, people would lose faith if they read an article that we were these crazy, like pseudo terrorists who are just coming through to ruin their park or something like that. And then they're like, oh, are those the people that we saw like eating lunch who, you know, like, our kids were talking to and who are like really nice to us and stuff. And, who, you know, picked up trash along the way or something, or worked in our community garden, you know. So, I mean, it's really awesome, and it's not only is it showing folks that we're not what the media says we are, it's giving them an opportunity to talk to people who might sympathize with some of the views that they've been afraid to express to their neighbors or to their fellow workers. Some people will, like, kind of, like, hush, hush, be like, I think you're totally right, you know, like, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, why don't you, you know, come on, say it out loud. It's fine. Like, that's what we need right now. We need to say these things loudly. So it's giving, hopefully it's like giving a little spark to some people and liberating some of their desires to express themselves on a more realistic level. I mean, no one has faith in either John Kerry or George Bush or either party. The vast majority of people are like, yeah, obviously, but what's your point? So we've kind of learned. I've learned that we're not on to something new. We're actually just homing in on popular opinion, and that's why it's been such a great march.
What inspires you to write the songs that you've been writing?
Boy, I haven't written a song for a little bit. I've been kind of had some writer's block and since the march, I seriously haven't had time to sit down and even hum a tune to myself, mainly. But, mainly it's anger, and I don't often really write songs that are inspired by something that's positive and inspirational. Like, I wrote 3 songs after the Miami protests, not because I was necessarily inspired, but more so because I saw so many people get beaten up by the police. And, you know, watching a speech by George Bush or John Kerry will always inspire a song. Just, you know, I guess looking at the negatives and trying to put them in a perspective that I can understand and that other people can understand. Talking to people always inspires me. A lot of I've picked up little tidbits and quotes from people as I've been walking just in my head. I oftentimes will write a song just based on one sentence somebody said that really inspired me. I was in West Virginia recently at a coal protest against some big coal companies having their little meeting, and I performed a few songs for the rally and heard some amazing speakers. And one woman from the southwest coal fields of West Virginia was talking about her struggle and how, you know, basically everyone in her background was a coal miner and they had been consistently exploited by the coal companies, and she just said, my husband's a coal miner, and he won't strip mine, and if they want him to strip mine, he's going to quit his job. And she said how people asked her, like, how can he just quit his job? And she said, it's fine. She's like, well, we're poor. We've always been poor, but we'll make it. And I thought, we've always been poor, but we'll make it. How inspiring is that quote? Like, that's a really awesome. So, you know, expect a song of that nature.
How about this song about the FBI coming to your house? Is that your true experience from yourself? You're organizing and the FBI came to your house, or is this a friend?
That's certainly a true experience. I was actually 17 years old when the FBI first came to my house, so that was 3 years ago. It was before September 11th that they came the first time, you know, and a friend's house as well, asking, you know, are you a communist? Are you going to the Free Mumia protest at the end of the month? Are you going to the World Bank protest in September? You know, are you, you know, involved with this group and that group? What are the names of some of the people in your group? Things like that. Yeah, I've thought about that recently because there was recently the string of FBI harassment cases in the Midwest involving various anarchists. You know, like, it's so screwed up to see in the media and just off of people's lips, like, people, you know, like, even in my family and my friends who are like, oh, well, I mean, you know, obviously they're investigating terrorism. You know, it's legitimate. Like, you know, it was the, you know, the Colorado Joint Terrorism Task Force or the Kansas Joint Terrorism Task Force. And, you know, that sounds like a really important job and a really important group who's out protecting people. But the folks who came to my house and asked me if I was a communist was the Maryland Joint Terrorism Task Force. And it was like the Baltimore County Intelligence Unit and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Baltimore chapter. And they weren't investigating terrorism. They weren't protecting anybody. All they were doing was putting me on a list and trying to build more names on their list. And it was totally just political. You know, they were just seeking political activists to put them in a file and watch us. And they consistently since then have watched our protests and photographed us and videotaped us and occasionally talked to people and the police tension with our activist community in my hometown, Towson, Baltimore County, has just escalated, and the police are more, they're often asking different young punk kids if they know myself and some of my friends, and if they're involved in groups, and, I mean, it's like ridiculous. So when I see, you know, when I hear about the FBI is, you know, investigating some terrorism in an activist circle, it's always just the red scare coming back. And, I mean, you're going to see that in New York. I'm sure the FBI is going to be detaining people left and right. Maybe I'll get detained, but since we're on the radio now, just make sure you know it's seriously, they're just looking for activists, not people who have broken laws.
Do you encourage people to use their real names when organizing? And what are some of the benefits and what are some of the cons of using your real name when organizing?
That's a good question. I think that people do need to use their real names, and people do need to hide their identities doing different work. It's really important. I have no choice now as I use my name. When I started organizing when I was like 15, and I mean, at this point, I mean, cops come up to me in my hometown and they're like, hey, Ryan, you know, Harvey, use my middle name. They know my birthday. They'll say my birthday to me sometimes and be like, yeah, so, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, like, it's cool. Like, I understand. You guys have all my info. That's just wonderful. I kind of got tricked into giving my name to the police when I was younger, thinking I had to. And, you know, I wish I had known, but it's, you know, it's irrelevant now. So people need to use their real names if they want to do above-ground work. Well, they don't need to, but it helps because it's legitimate for some people who are not exposed to that community yet. And it can be encouraging. It can be a courageous thing to do. It can be self-fulfilling to be able to have the FBI come up to you and to be able to say, yes, you know, I am, you know, whatever your name is. And yes, I am an anarchist and I do organize. Yes. And I do oppose this government and I do oppose the war and I do oppose free trade. And what are you going to do about it? And to be able to do that is like, you're putting them in their place. You know, to be able to say, you've got my name right, what's your name? What are you doing here? You know, and turn it around, just how powerful that can be. And to stand up to power, you know, like, it's really liberating. But, I mean, and also, you know, it's really also a good idea if you're doing work to not expose your name so that you don't get affected by the paranoia and the stress that, you know, I know I've dealt with it, and paranoia destroyed the group that we had when the FBI came to our houses because we got paranoid because, you know, we'd have a meeting and a car full of detectives would pull up and start photographing us. And while we were planning completely legal and legitimate actions, you know, we were getting, you know, surveillance tape taken of us by detectives from the Baltimore County Police Department. So it drove us insane because, you never know what they could do. They've got so much power, and they've done it to people in the past. They did it to the Black Panthers. They did it to the American Indian Movement, to the Yippies, to, revolutionary groups since, you know, the system started have been sought out by whatever, you know, it wasn't always the FBI, but, I mean, the Wobblies were destroyed by the same thing, and the early socialist workers movements were destroyed by the same thing. So it makes you paranoid. So if you have the ability to remain anonymous and do action and do action that matters, I think that's like heavily encouraged as well. So it works on both fronts, above ground and underground, and anonymous and outright public.
And what can we do in the face of such info wars that we're experiencing? I'm sure you heard just Saturday night, the New York City indie media team had their benefit shut down by various agencies in New York. I don't know if you heard about that.
I didn't.
Okay, yeah. There was a benefit for the indie media video team in New York City, and there was music that was organized and things like that, and there was also a showing of the Miami Model, the new documentary. There was just different agents of the health and building departments that came along with different factions of the police departments, and they found code violations, and they shut down that video screening.
Terrific. They probably just wanted to confiscate the Miami Model because it exposes so much of the oppression that we talk about all pushed together into one 5-hour, 10-hour experience. I don't know. I mean, I expect that to continue happening. We had punk spaces in the Baltimore area shut down just because of that fire by that band. I don't remember which band it was. Great White, maybe? I don't remember which band. Some 80s band.
I heard about something like that.
Hmm?
Yeah, I think it was Great White.
Yeah, they had a show in Rhode Island, and they used pyrotechnics, and they screwed up, and they burnt the club, and a lot of people died. They then shut down the housing department, and the police shut down two of our DIY punk spaces, saying that they didn't want a fire to occur. And, you know, of course, we were like, we're not using pyrotechnics, so what's the deal? But they really used that as, a means to shut down our spaces. And, I mean, they did that in New York before Miami to the anarchist people of color had a benefit show, and the cops came in and, I think they even, like, beat people up and stuff and shut the show down. They have so much power. They can really do whatever they want. It's just really important to get it out publicly that, you know, like I was just saying with the FBI coming to my house, it's really important. I tell that story because it's important so that people know, to make that public, so that people know when this happens that it's not what they say it is. If they shut down a show space and say, a political fundraiser for, you know, an anti-government group or even just a radical group of any sort, and say, oh, we were concerned about a fire hazard. No, like, they were concerned about social change, and there's fire hazards everywhere. That's not what they care about. And while, I don't know, it's going to keep happening. People just have to know what's going on, and hopefully that will slow things down a bit. The government's afraid to act on those things when there's lots of people around who are willing to take action against it. So it's really important that we protect our local spaces from these kinds of things and help each other put them up to fire code if that's the necessary thing, and see what they use as the next excuse to shut the space down. They in Philadelphia during the RNC in the year 2000, they raided the puppet space and said that, they have various complaints, and they did it in Quebec City, and they did it, they've done it at almost every major mobilization. They've raided the art spaces and been like, look, they were making explosives, you know, because they had paint thinner and rags, you know, just like a carpenter does, or a paint store, or a department store, or, you know, various other places. So, I don't know, it's just really important that we home into their tricks. They're always using the same tricks, and they're just painting them a little differently.
Why don't you talk about copyrights and how you distribute your music? How do you feel about copyrights?
I never copyright any of my stuff. It started because I didn't know how to. And then, I mean, I put on my CDs that I wrote the songs, because I did, typically. Some of them I've taken tunes from old Phil Oak songs or old folk songs, which is the folk tradition, and I think it's awesome. I encourage people to take my songs and burn CDs, distribute them, put them online, put them on the radio, do whatever you want with them, don't sell them. Sell them if you need to raise money for your info shop or for an event you're putting on. Yeah, I don't imagine, you know, non-radical groups doing things I didn't approve of would be able to sell my music as a fundraiser, but I mean, it's out there. I don't want to hold them to myself. Like, a lot of people are like, you need to copyright your stuff, you know, blah blah blah. I don't care. I mean, they're topical songs. A lot of them will be outdated in like a month, so I just got to keep writing and keep putting them out. If somebody steals all my songs somehow, I'll just write new ones. I don't know. People will know. I don't know. Yeah, I don't really worry about it too much. It's not a big deal. I think music should be free, and especially social music of the kind that I write. People need to hear it, and I don't expect people to pay for it. It's my opinions, and my opinions are free. I play guitar because I love it, and that's free too, so... I mean, I take donations, like, from people when I have CDs, but if people don't have money, I give them the CD for free, or I give them the website, and you can download. I think I have, like, 40 MP3s up there right now. And I think it's really exciting when I meet other artists, radical artists, who have non-copyrighted music and give it away for free. I think that's... We're taking music back from capitalism, because capitalism is ever-expanding and has captured music very well. Everyone... I mean, if you make music, you have to copyright it and sell it nowadays. I mean, that's what you have to do. That's why people write music. You know, it's. I mean, it's really crazy. So I'd like, you know, add a little voice to taking music back.
You've been traveling across the country. You've been involved in a lot of different campaigns. It's evident from the MP3s that I can download off your website, from the Siskiyou to Miami to Boston, you know, now to New York. What do you see? Kind of across this country, what ties these places together? How are they different? Like, I imagine the Pacific Northwest has got to be a lot different than Miami.
The Pacific Northwest is an amazing place, but I mean, so is like the poor areas of Baltimore City, and you know, like it's crazy coming from like Overtown in Miami, where the Convergence Center was, and seeing the poverty that people have to endure there, and then you know, seeing. You know, I mean, the Pacific Northwest, seeing what companies have done to the forests up there. I mean, one thing that ties them together is the companies themselves. Obviously, like the folks in charge of cutting all the forests in the Northwest down aren't living in like one of the poor lumber towns up there. They're living in nice homes in Texas or in nice places across the country where they can just make phone calls and emails and get forests destroyed. I mean, in Miami, and a lot of the people who have the ability to travel to different mobilizations and like lend their bodies to the events and risk, you know, injury and risk their lives, especially like in the case of Miami, to try to expose like the corporations and the government's lies, I think is one thing that ties them all together. And also just the general poverty of it all. It's all linked together through the economics just of the system in place. Very few times have I seen a city where the downtown banking district turns so quickly into the ghetto, Miami, and also in we just walked through a town that actually was exactly like that. It was in Hartford. The poor community turns right into a college in half a block, and everything is different. But I mean, they're all laid out the same way, and there's the same politics at hand. In the Pacific Northwest, loggers, you know, start at, you know, less than $10 an hour sometimes, cutting down the world's oldest trees. they're paid, you know, less than you start at Kinko's selling copies of old growth paper. And then in places like Miami, like in the I forget what they call them down there, something like free zones or some crap that are basically maquiladoras, where people work in, you know, like sub sweatshop, you know, kind of standards for this country and produce garments and stuff. And I don't know, it's all the same policies at hand, and the police are the same. Look at Portland and Asheville and Miami and, you know, New York and all these other cities. The police act the same way, and it's getting more hostile as they get more desperate to just make us shut up already. I mean, in Miami was a really good example that they were not screwing around. They were not willing to let us have an inch of space in which to, like, broadcast our message, and they used pretty much every weapon I've ever seen at any protest ever in Miami for about, you know, 1,000 people in the morning and then about 10,000 in the afternoon. And that was all federal tax money as well, which also ties a lot of these things together, is that it's our collectively all 300 million of us paying taxes going to buy weapons for the police to beat up demonstrators who are trying to save this place. And, you know, the rest of that money going to weapons to go bomb other countries with, to destroy them and further, you know, corporations grasp on things. So yeah, I mean, I see it as all linked together. Doesn't matter where in this country you go, you'll find the same exact stuff happening. It'll look different, it'll be called different things, it'll involve different people, maybe especially on the receiving end of the oppression.
You have a song Cops of the World, where it's not certainly, it's not just, you know, the nation, it's not just the cops in the nation, but it's really all across the world where a lot of these models are actually being enforced.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's like the same policies that our government used against workers in, like, the late 1800s and the early 1800s, the corporations use them against workers in Latin America and in Southeast Asia and stuff. And they've exported a lot of the jobs that were causing a lot of the stir in the 1800s to low-wage countries, that they've made low-wage countries that weren't low-wage countries before. So, you know, I mean, like, as I learn more about the history of this country and of just imperialism, I see it as, it's the exact same. It's no different. The country's no different than it was in the 1830s or the 1870s. We've just moved some of the stuff to different places, and we've painted it differently, and we've made a few people richer to try to make it seem a little better. And the government's learned how to maintain itself and how to combat scrutiny and how to put people down. But it's the same exact tactics. You look at what they did to the IWW in the 20s, and then you look at what they did to the Black Panthers, and you look at what they're doing to us now, and it's really the exact same policies. It looks a little different, but it's, I mean, if you were to look at it in a simplified version, it would be identical.
Talk about folk music and history. It's kind of like you have songs, Ballad of the Baltimore Rebellion and the Kent State Massacre. Obviously, history is very important to you. How does that tie into folk music? And because you don't really, I mean, you're the only folk musician I know.
What's that?
You're the only folk musician I know.
Oh, wow.
There's not many folk musicians like.
There's tons of us running around on the march right now.
Yeah.
I guess there's the new generation of radical folk singers. folk music has played such a huge role in history that, it's like Woody Guthrie is in history textbooks because he had such an effect on people, because he really sang the music of the people at the time. I know, you know, if he was around today, he'd be singing the same songs because not that much has changed. Yeah, and I mean, as far as history, like, I really seek to write more historical ballads, because knowing our history, like, for me, has been the most liberating thing, because it's really taught me that, like I was just talking about, that nothing's changed. But very few things have changed. Nothing systematically has changed. You know, to be able to, like, I can sing one of those songs that you just mentioned, and I can teach people a story, and they'll know names and places and dates and, you know, the story of an event and maybe a little bit about the background. And I got that inspired, was by Woody Guthrie. He did the same thing, and many other people have. I mean, it's storytelling, and it's so important because if our history books are lying to us and the media is lying to us, and, you know, sometimes our parents are even lying to us because they were lied to and they were taught to lie, to have something catchy that's the truth is super important. You know, those things never die. Like a song never dies, but a book can be, you know, altered and stuff, you know. So I think that's really important, and it's really fun too to sing something with a nice melody that you can enjoy singing, that, you know, can actually teach people a story, but it isn't boring. All right, we're gonna have to wrap it up.
All right, that sounds good. I know you got a lot to do on the march.
Totally.
All right, well, thank you so much for calling. Thanks for helping organize and writing songs and putting them out there for free. We're a big fan of you here at Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Thanks for having me.
All right,
peace,
take care.
Mr. Bush, what can I say? They entrusted you to lead us down a path to better days, and here we are now. Two wars and no remorse, the poor getting poorer, situation's getting worse. You said we're doing fine, yeah, we're doing pretty fine. With our constant fear of truth mixed with our constant fear of you, we're sick and tired. Being treated as your tools, building riches for your buddies, while you make all the rules. Mr. Bush, what are you going to do about the starving in Washington, D.C., freezing on the marble steps of your policies? What's in it for the workers as the factories move away, trading freedom for the dollar? What a hefty price to pay. No respect for the common will of all, just the will to fight for power, throw our backs against the wall. Well, it's out there, Mr. Bush. It's written in the wind. When the system turns itself over, we're turning you in. Spaceship to go to Mars, so another billionaire can see the stars, wasting $11 billion that could be ours. And we ask for handouts, and we get a few things back, while the companies you sleep with get contracts in Iraq and put books on the shelves so they can educate themselves on the history of freedom as the rich man tells. Let them die right, let them know that hope is gone, and as more coffins come back home, we'll all chant, bring them on. Destruction, we know you lie. Actually, we're only asking because we think it's funny to see you hide. When the questions pile up, terror, secret labs, and more, nukes, anthrax, and smallpox, the plans for global war. Only place you've seen those things is in the USA, where the nuclear test ones banned are growing larger every day. You say it's him, not you, who brought this shit about. But we recognize double speak, and the truth is coming out, and you're going down. Now the Iraqis are fighting back. No surprise to me, I heard they almost got Wolfowitz. What a tragedy. Well, he shouldn't be there, making laws on foreign land. An unelected dictator under your commander for the homeland. The barracks for greed, home of Halliburton, Bechtel, Boeing, Lockheed, and GE. I bet they're happy building weapons for the war, casting votes to ensure that we keep crawling back for more, because they're profiting. Saddam Hussein to Hitler, and you would know the best, cause your granddad ran his banking operations with his friends, and your daddy funded Saddam, sold him missiles, guns, and gas. The poison he dropped on the Kurds was made in a U.S. lab. It's all fact. If you read between the lines, you'll find the same names and faces at the scenes of the crimes. Arms producers, war profiteers, arm in arm with politicians ever since the golden years. What a scam. Not the one. one to blame. It seems like everything is crazy. Yeah, but everything's the same. You see, it's always been this way since 1776. A government established just to benefit the rich, not the slaves, the natives, the women, or the poor. The landless peasants stranded, lying, dying on the shore. It's pretty clear. United state of fear. Well, the time is now to rise against the things that brought us here and take it back.